Jung writes in his autobiography, "I can vividly recall how Freud said to me, 'My dear Jung, promise me never to abandon the sexual theory. That is the most essential thing of all. You see, we must make a dogma of it, an unshakable bulwark.'" Well, the sexual theory was that idea that sexual repressions led to the material being put in that closed cellar of the unconscious. Jung goes on. "He said that to me with great emotion, in the tone of a father saying, 'And promise me this one thing, my dear son, that you will go to church every Sunday.' In some astonishment, I asked him, 'A bulk word? A bulk word against what?' To which he replied, 'Against the black tide of mud.'" And here he hesitated for a moment, and then he added, "of occultism." First of all, it was the words bulk word and dogma that alarmed me. For a dogma, that is to say, is an undisputable confession of faith. It is set up only when the aim is to suppress doubts once and for all. But that no longer has anything to do with scientific judgment, only with a personal power drive. A bulk word against the black tide of occultism. Now, what does that mean? Okay. Suppose psychology, our psyches, our interior worlds, are filled up only with material that comes from, well, this conscious life, space. They have a cellar, they have a bottom that gets filled up. We have a rational explanation, don't we, for the unconscious, for its complexes. We can develop ways of studying this life, what we experience here, and figuring out why we're so crazy, why we suffer from these maladies of the soul. We can dig down into that cellar. We can figure out where things came from up here in our conscious world and try to somehow bring awareness to this, take the costumes, strip them off of these demons dancing up from the basement, and, you know, well, heal people. But what if the unconscious, what if it doesn't have a floor? Where does it go? Where does it come from, better stated? Where do these roots sink to? Where do they start? And this was what Jung was beginning to see. It's a duality, you see. Duality. There is a material reality. And that material reality is crossed, is intersected, is in relationship with a secondary reality, which might again be called the first and primary reality, the reality of the soul, of the psyche. The stuff in the unconscious, our personal unconscious, our unconscious domain as a culture, did not come there just from our personal experience. It has roots that sink into the history of our race. It has roots that sink beyond time to a primary reality, to a rhizome, eternal and pre-existent. Occultism, isn't that? Occultism. That was the sort of occultism that Freud wished to build a bulk word against. Because all of a sudden, soul, psyche, starts getting mixed up with something called spirit, a breath of life. To Jung, the bucket had no bottom. The cellar had no floor. So he was realizing in 1913. And he realized, too, that if he was to know anything about this unconscious, this cellar, he needed to descend the staircase. He needed to enter into it. He needed to go there. Oh, yes, of course, he had his dreams. All of his life he had had them. And he had had the things, the experiences, the senses. But Jung knew that he needed to descend. He needed to meet, shall we say, the Balrog at the bridge of Karadum and face it up. Descend with it. See where it went. He thought perhaps he was on the verge of a psychosis, about to descend into madness, because he, if anyone did, knew what madness was, having lived for more than half a decade with the incurably insane. He sat at his desk in 1913, after a period of intense dreams, prophetic-seeming dreams. He sat and thought, now I must do it. I must descend. And so he closed his eyes, and suddenly he felt the floor beneath him give way. He felt himself falling, 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 as if to the moon. And then suddenly he landed. He stood up and looked around. It was a dark and murky world. There, in the distance, he saw three figures. And he went up, approached to talk. One was an old man, and he announced himself to be Elijah. The other was a young woman. Her name was Salome. She was blind. The third figure was a snake. And the snake took a particular interest in Jung. There's a bit more to that vision, but I'll stop it there. He came around. What had happened? An imposition. A vision. It was the first of many. He began an exercise, shall we say, of allowing himself to fall into this imaginal world. And perhaps a bit like a Tolkien living just a decade later, myth and the language of this unseen world became very real. He had a dream of a blue kingfisher, large bird with vivid blue wings. The bird, however, was not a bird. It was an angel. Philemon, he announced himself. Jung describes him as having a Greco-Roman type of character, and he carried in his hand a key. The night after this dream, he went out into his yard, and there was a dead kingfisher bird, a bird that was very seldom, if ever, seen in the environs there of Zurich. Philemon actually constellated himself, shall we say, a figment of the imagination. Philemon started showing up to walk in the garden with Jung at lunchtime. Jung would go out after his lunch and walk in the garden and talk to Philemon. Well, that's not so extraordinary. The extraordinary thing is that Philemon talked back. Jung came to see Philemon as his teacher. He describes in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections how Philemon said to him things, taught him things that he never would have thought. And of course, Jung confronted Philemon. You're just a figment of my imagination. I'm making you up. Philemon's response was, if you walked into a room full of people and you saw them sitting there, would you think you made them up? Well, Jung thought about that, and he was there. And he says that through that experience, through Philemon's words, I realized that the imaginal, the imagination, has its own reality. Its own reality. An independent reality. Imaginal. Fictive. story, myth. Put those words on a vertical axis, will you? Fact, history, material. Put that on a horizontal axis, if you will. Now, if you want to understand the psychology of Jung, understand it is centered at the center of that cross. Fictive and fact. Imaginal, real. Unconscious, conscious. They cross, and it is at their touching point, that we find the magic. Jung spent these years from 1914 to about 1920, when things settled down, lost in a voyage across a dark sea. The waters were rough at times. At times he thought perhaps he was going insane. But he stabilized himself with his associations with family. He continued his practice as a physician. He told very, very, very few people about what was going on. As somebody once suggested to me, the difference between a madman and a mystic is that the mystic knows who not to talk to. It's a fine distinction. Well, he knew who not to talk to. And, you know, in many ways, he knew who not to talk to for the rest of his life. Because a lot of this stuff, he never put into writing. He didn't put this into his scientific work, you see. It was only at the end of his life when those who knew him imposed upon him to tell his story. And finally he did tell it in that book, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Story, his story. You want his history? You can find it. Deirdre Baer wrote a very good collection of history, but you won't find his story there. The story you'll have to look elsewhere for. And you might start with his own rendition. Now, of course, he was confronted with something in this period. Well, he was confronted with something quite strange. He was confronted with the unconscious, an unconscious that he came to call a collective unconscious. It wasn't just his. It wasn't just his personal stuff. Oh, of course, in our unconscious realm, in the unseen, imaginal realm, there does reside a whole lot of stuff. Very, very personal. But he was moving beyond that into something he felt was actually collective. Images shared across time by life. And he was faced in this period with three options. He started writing a book. It's the Red Book, it's called. I think it has, almost 1,300 pages in it. There are some pictures of it around, a few scattered pages of found photographic form. It is illuminated with paintings. It's like a medieval illuminated manuscript. And the art is actually quite compelling. Amongst the things he has in this book is a very fine painting of his spiritual mentor, emphasis on spirit in this case, Philemon, an individual who he painted upon the wall of his tower in Bollingen as well. And he wrote, "The hand in this Red Book," as he called it, is a medieval script in Greek, in Latin, in Old German. It's mythic. And as he went through this creative period, he asked himself again three questions. Am I an artist? Well, that's one way you see it, looking at this creative experience. I mean, what is the true creative energy of an artist but a touching of something transpersonal that channels itself through one? And he was creating myths, stories, things he might have turned into a Tolkien-esque, I suppose, creation. In fact, he did. He wrote a little book called The Seven Sermons of the Dead, to the dead, Septem Sermones ad Mortuos is how he titled it. It is something of a myth, mythic creation. And there are voices inside of him that said, yes, that's what you are. You're an artist. Ultimately, he rejected that. The next obvious idea, am I then, if not an artist, a prophet? Well, okay. That's one we're familiar with. A realm is contacting one, crossing into the material. The vision that seems to be coming certainly has religious elements, some darker, some lighter. In fact, a complexio of dark and light. But it seems very much a thing, an imposition of the spirit. Am I then a prophet? Am I here to start a new religion? To write its prophetic books? Well, he considered it. He considered it. And rejected it. He came to decide there was only one course. He was one thing. He was a physician. He was a scientist. And he was a scientist with an empirical interest in exploration. He was here to explore the psyche. He was not to be its conduit as an artistic creator. He was not to be its mouthpiece as a prophet. He was to be an explorer of the psyche, an explorer. An explorer, a mapper, one who was made wise, shall we say, by a vision, a dual vision, a vision of an unseen realm crossing a seen realm. And that wise and visionary one, who had seen, would then be a guide. A guide. A bit like our old image of the wizard. Guide, wizard, vision, wise, guide. But of course, as he came out of this period, he had to ask himself a question. Well, probably several questions. First question is, am I just simply insane? He asked that question, and he decided that he was not simply insane, although perhaps complexly insane. To find some ground for understanding what he had been through, and his empirical investigations of that unconscious realm, he had to find in history other places, other humans who had had the same experience, other individuals who in the realm of their lives had been touched by a realm of spirit, who had experienced what he had experienced. You know, he'd been looking for that since he was a kid, remember? And he hadn't found it in the theologians. He hadn't found it in the religion of his day. He hadn't found it in philosophy. Now he really went looking. Where? Where are those who have experienced this before? Because if no one else has experienced it before, then indeed I am a complex madman. A madman with complexes, perhaps, as well. Well, the first place he went looking, I'll just read a bit again. As my life entered its second half, I was already embarked on the confrontation with the contents of the unconscious. My work on this was an extremely long, drawn-out affair, and it was only after some 20 years of it that I reached some degree of understanding of my fantasies. But first, I had to find evidence for the historical prefiguration of my inner experiences. That is to say, I had to ask myself, Where had my particular premises already occurred in history? If I had not succeeded in finding such evidence, I would never have been able to substantiate my ideas. So I might reread that a little bit. If I hadn't found anyone else who had gone into this realm, I would have no objective comparison for what had happened to me. He knew that he simply couldn't stand and talk from his experience. To do so would be to take upon oneself the mantle of a prophet, or perhaps of an artist. But as a scientist, he had to find evidence that this was part of the general, more general, human condition. And so he went looking, first into old church history. And there he found, in the annals of the heresiologists, those who had persecuted the ancient heresies of Christianity, evidence of a cult, as it was called, a heresy called Gnosticism, from the word gnosis, Greek to know. The Gnostics had apparently felt there was an experience available to humankind, though available in portion only to some limited number, perhaps, those so disposed. A knowledge that came from experience of the unseen realm, the spiritual world. Their religion was a mythic religion. It was based in a primary vision. It told stories. Their books, well, for the most part, they had actually been destroyed by those persecuting their heresy. They were dangerous books. They were visions. They were gospels. Gospels not quite like the gospel we know. In fact, if there's anything in the gospels as we have them, in the New Testament as we have them, like some of these Gnostic writings, it would be the thing known as the revelation, the apocalypse. And that's what apocalypse means, the revelation of John. A very strange dream it was that dear John had, this revelation. But books like that, there are many apocalypses, visions. There was a gospel of Mary of Magdala we spoke about last year. Well, these were destroyed. But evidence was left of them in the writing of those who persecuted them, in the evidence they presented against them, in the writings of Irenaeus and Hippolytus and Tertullian, the old church fathers. There was evidence of what these folks had thought. And in them, Jung saw something he recognized. Something he recognized from his own journey. It wasn't so much just having vision. It was what was seen in the vision. Because there were contours, natures, types of things that came out of this unconscious. It wasn't just a hodgepodge, but from Jung's encounter with the unconscious, he started finding form, what he called archetypes, primary images that were recurrent, that seemed primal. He found evidence of this in Christian Gnosticism. But of course, it was too many years. Too long had passed. Too much, to him, had been lost, though later in his life it was indeed to be found. The large cache of Gnostic documents known as the Nag Hammadi Library were found in 1945, toward the end of Jung's life. And indeed, the first of those documents to be recognized for what it was, smuggled out of Egypt to Europe, is known as the Jung Codex of the Nag Hammadi Library. And it's known so because it was actually Jung, through the agencies of a young scholar by the name of Gilles Quispel, who purchased on the black market that first and most important Gnostic text. An interesting sidelight. But at that time, in the early part of this century, 1915-25 period, there was too little. Jung needed to find another road. And eventually he did. It was called alchemy, a medieval art linked, to wizards, magic, occultism, a dark tide of occultism it was. And in that science, that knowing, that art, that vision of the Middle Ages, Jung began to find evidence that others had indeed shared with him. A journey to an unseen world. We will turn to that journey next week as we continue our exploration of this tradition of vision and Jung's encounter with alchemy. So thank you very much. Thank you, and I have actually now left time for questions. Don't feel obliged. I mean, don't feel pressured. But if there are any, or any discussion desired, yes?
What's the story on the Red Book?
The Red Book. Oh, yeah, I'm glad you asked that. The Red Book. Well, I have secret information that I can't share with you. But I did find a public note in Deirdre Baer's biography, which, look, I admit, I really enjoyed the biography. It was really detailed. There was a lot of the dirt, you know, the low-down nitty-gritty that I'd always sort of wanted to find out. I sort of knew after reading just about everything about Jung, in biographies, there are a whole lot of things I'd pretty much figured out, but she really did some great research, and she got documentation and gave some insights that I would have never had otherwise. She missed the whole story, unfortunately, but anyway, lots of puzzle pieces. If you already got a map, they fit together. And in her extensive footnotes, which take up about a third of the book, which I read also, there is one footnote which says that as of last summer, a year ago summer, the Jung family was actually considering preparing a facsimile edition of the Red Book for publication. I've heard nothing more, and I've kept my ear open. And I think that's that she got from a family member, and it was put in print. Now, I should also add that my own analyst and dear old friend by the name of Gregory Santos, who some of you may have known when he was here in Salt Lake many years ago. Gregory was at the Institute in Zurich in the 1970s and spoke then to Jung's grandson, who assured him that the Red Book was going to be published in the next 5 years. And that's now been 24 years, or well, it's more like 30 years, but whatever, give or take a few. Okay, so, but the Red Book, you see, several pages of it have been published. They were published in a book, I think it's called C.G. Jung in Word and Image. It's a large format, like coffee table book. And in it, there are 10 or so pages reproduced from the Red Book. Amazing images. Throughout his life, Jung allowed several people to look at parts of the Red Book. He allowed a few individuals time to perhaps flip through it at more extended leisure. The thing I believe counts to about 1,300 pages, if I remember correctly, and my memory may be faulty here. 1,332 is the number that comes, but I suspect it's wrong. That may be the negative account on my bank statement. Oh, do remember that little jar in the back. But anyway, the book also is very strange because it is really a visionary world. If I could give you maybe you look for examples, other people that had similar experiences, because if you put them side by side, you get the feeling this guy is not crazy alone, that there's other, there are other crazies in this pattern. Well, if I look at Tolkien's garage full of Silmarillion manuscripts, I see a bit of the Red Book in that. The Red Book is, however, a bit more cohesive, linear. And it has in it a vast amount of material that came right from this creative period, 1914 to 1920. But he continued adding to it throughout his life. And he added the last leaves to the Red Book at the end of his life. The family of Jung is a very conservative bourgeois corporation. And they are very protective of his scientific legacy. And have been very resistant to putting the Red Book out into public hands for those reasons. It may be that they have eventually reached a point where they're willing to do it. Perhaps they see a bit of money in it. I don't think there's anyone who's particularly concerned about giving forth some great revelation at this point in the family. Maybe I'm wrong. But I believe it will be available sometime, probably several years after my own death, however. I would like to take a look. I would say he's both. A psychologist, what does it mean? It means a student of the psyche, yeah?
Well, I thought, though, that you had to have medicine in order to be a psychologist.
Yeah. So we use these words, and they're just words. They're ways we wrap our tongue around concepts. And when we say psychologist, we mean, well, logos, a study, word of, student of the psyche, the soul. Psychiatrist, well, we start thinking, well, he's a medical doctor who's a psychologist. In this day and age, what it means is if you're a psychologist, you talk to people. If you're a psychiatrist, you write them prescriptions and kick them out in 5 minutes. But you get more from the insurance company for doing that.
Nowadays, if you're a physician's assistant,
you can... Oh, yes, of course. Okay. Yeah. I have to add that in. You know, really, that's actually what's happened, though, in this day, is that when you're a psychiatrist, you don't have time. I mean, you can't sit down for an analytic session. No one pays you for, especially if you're a Jungian mystic. Good God, you're not going to, Blue Cross isn't going to pay you 80% of bill charges. So, and not only that, this therapy of the soul, it's difficult. Well, first of all, you have to have some sense of what a soul is. And second, it of course is extremely useful if you've actually encountered it yourself, you know, gone through this process, because you're not going to guide anywhere to, anywhere that you haven't been yourself, and that you don't know, all right? And the truth of the matter is, most people don't know a whole lot about it, but they do know serotonin chemistry. And I do not belittle serotonin chemistry, because believe me, it does help. I mean, you know, some of the problems of life, in fact, Jung said all major problems of life, they're really insoluble. All we can do is find meaning. Find a story that gives reason to the misery of this world. If you aren't miserable, well, you may be incurably insane. If you aren't miserable sometimes, I mean, really, look, life, as the Buddha said, is suffering in varying degrees. The key is given, I guess, in the Gnostic Gospels. If you only knew how to suffer, you would not have suffered, they said. If you only knew how to suffer, you would not have suffered. The words of the Logos in Gnostic text. What does that mean? Maybe that knowing how to suffer is knowing how to find the meaning in the suffering of this life. Knowing how to find that vertical cross. The old Gnostics had a cross that they made. It was of two words. Zoe, with an omega in the center, Zoe, which means life, zoology, and Phos, with an omega in the middle. Zoe on this axis, Phos on this axis. Life, light. And they met in the omega. Life. We're all hanging on that cross, and light. If we can find the center point, that omega, where life meets light, then perhaps we find the magic that teaches us how to suffer and not suffer so. Yeah, as some of you may know, I've spent the last 25 years working as an emergency physician. I remember a vision I had of sorts one day in a emergency room in Southern California. I think it was about 3 in the morning. And I had this vision of myself as sitting amidst the teeth in the jaws of the great god Shiva, with a little pitchfork trying to throw pieces of meat back out before he swallowed them. Picking the teeth of Shiva with a trident was the image. And believe me, there have been nights like that. But in that life spent in the teeth of Shiva, I've encountered an awfully lot of real insanity, schizophrenia, you know. And this is really what Jung dealt with in the Bergholz. He lived in the sanitarium, and there were a lot of incurably insane individuals. He's usually had schizophrenia, and Jung was a specialist, and Jung's teacher, his name was Bueller, wrote the classic textbook on schizophrenia. And what's the problem in schizophrenia? There's an absolute dissolution of the boundary of self, of ego. The demons and the visions become so powerful that they overwhelm any sense of self. It disintegrates. There is no ego left. And when that perspective, relationship, you see, history and imaginal, the fact of the ego and the unconscious, they have to be in a relationship, one-sided. Either way, the thing on the single side declares itself, I alone am God. Well, in our world, we meet a whole lot of ego standing up, puffed up. I alone am the almighty wisdom. Like the Wizard of Oz, you know, behind the curtain. That's the ego in our world, isn't it? Science, I don't know the truth. Fact. Well, we deal with that, but believe me, it's safer to be on that side of the road than on the other, in the unconscious, where that ego is gone and all the gods claim you as their food. You really do go down the throat of old Shiva. So that is schizophrenia. Yes, you're quite right. And this is the important thing in Jung, is that he went there knowing that it was the realm of psychosis, shall we say. But he kept a scientific perspective. He kept the attitude of an intact ego. There are moments when he almost lost it. He says that. I mean, clearly, he says there are times when he'd become so agitated he'd have to sit. He did Eastern meditations to try to calm himself, breathing exercises to try to control what was going on.
About the status of Jungian therapy, there seems to be an ample number of books written by therapists. I mean, it's still rather skeptically looked at by people who consider themselves really scientists. What is the status of
them? Beats me. I know that they're not doing very well financially. I know this because I have friends and associates who tried to make a living as Jungian therapists, or who sort of hang out in that society. And there are a few people that find patients who are able to pay them. But the problem is that if you make it your job, you really do actually have to make a living from it. You know, you have to find people, and if you're a Jungian therapist, and that's you hang out your, you know, the plaque on the wall, and you open the door, and you pay for the heat and the office and the comfortable chair there. You got to have people coming in and paying. And the problem is that it costs a whole heck of a lot for those therapeutic hours to keep that old office going. And insurance companies really don't pay, and people have to pay out of pocket. For a limited number of visits. But Jungian therapy, in a sense, was more than limited number. It sometimes went for a couple of years. This, and the second thing is, for a therapeutic relationship to work, the guide has to know what the landscape is. You can only guide a person as far as you've been on a trail. After that, you're both at sea, shall we say. You're both lost in the woods. Well, if you're going to be lost in the woods, it's probably nice to be with somebody. But you may just stay there lost together. The idea is, can you make it through the woods? And I, in my own judgment, you know, Jungian therapy has become, in many eyes, in many ways, a methodology. You know, people learn the methods. They learn the terminology. They learn about complexes and, you know, they know the word archetype and they have an image of what that might be and they know about wise old men and they know a little bit about fairy tales. But very few are those who have descended, who have really walked that path themselves and come back alive to tell the tale. It just unfortunately is so. And so what is accomplished in the Jungian therapeutic process, although it may be productive, may be somewhat limited simply by the rareness of what this is. In a way, that's why I encourage anybody considering the subject to go back and look at the old man himself. Go back and look at the wizard. Don't judge others by him. Don't even judge him by himself. I mean, some of what you're seeing is what you're making up. It's what you're projecting upon him. But what you're projecting upon the analyst or Jung, it's coming from inside of you, that wizard image, that idea of the guide. And ultimately, I think we have to look inside ourselves, you know, to find that guide image. We can't really expect another human being to do it. Oh, they may evoke from us the image of that, the projection. But ultimately, we have to start bringing that projection back in. And physician, heal thyself. Goes for the analyst, goes for the patient. Now they call them clients. You aren't patients anymore. You're clients. Because clients pay bills. Hmm?
Didn't Freud and Jung have an official part in the
Oasis? Yeah. You might call it an official explosion. Jung, in 1913, Jung wrote a book published actually in 1912 called, what was it called in the original? Symbols of Transformation is the title on the book right now, but it had another title in its first publication. And in this, Jung really revealed his rejection of the sexual theory. He went on an exploration of the myths of humanity and found in that mythological material evidence of this collective, this shared experience of the unconscious, which he was about to embark into himself. Jung knew that when he sent Freud the manuscript of this book, the relationship would be over. He sent him the manuscript in 1912, and believe me, it was over. Because the good son wasn't going to church no more. And so there was a problem there. They parted ways. They really, I think, after 1913, never spoke again or communicated. The entire Freudian community turned against Jung. There was a big division. I mean, there are some people in Zurich and other places who sort of stayed on the Jung side, which became analytic psychology. And the Freudian side was psychoanalysis. Turn things around there. Jung lost most of his associates. He lost much of his standing in that group. That was pretty much what he gave up to go his own way.